This is Bob Lang with the Oral History Project of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today is November 3rd, 2005. The interview today is with Dr. James A. Thompson, the John D. MacArthur Professor of Anatomy in the UW-Madison Medical School, also with the Wisconsin Regional Primate Research Center and Scientific Director at Wiesel Research Institute. Since you said I could call you Jamie, I'm going to. Jamie, let's start with your early years, when you were born, where you were born, your family, and your early education up through high school graduation.
Okay. I was born in the Chicago area at West Suburban Hospital in 1958. And I grew up in the River Forest, Oak Park area, and went to school there all the way through high school. My parents are not scientists. My mother was an executive assistant for a local college professor, and my father was a CPA.
Uh-huh. Did you go to the public schools? Or?
Yeah, I went entirely through public schools all the way through undergraduate.
Did you early focus in on science? Or?
I always remember thinking science was kind of neat, and I guess if I was asked as a little kid what I'd be when I want to grow up, it'd be something in the sciences. Specifically what I wanted to do was not particularly clear, but I liked the biological sciences from an early time. I can't remember really specific examples of what steered me in that direction, but I just always liked it.
Uh-huh. In one of the articles I read about you, you mentioned an uncle who was
Uncle Jack,
at NASA.
Yeah.
Was he a significant influence on your science?
You know, in some ways, not exactly. He worked out at Huntsville at the Marshall Space Facility, and he was an engineer.
Oh.
And he was an engineer when he got out of the Army. He joined what was then called the Redstone Project, and that was right prior to NASA being created. And then when NASA was created, he moved over to NASA, and then he worked his entire professional career at NASA up until the point that the space shuttle was launched. And can you imagine a career that bracketed something more cool than that?
I really can't.
And he told me when he's going for his interview, you know, he still had his Army uniform on and everything, and he went to this big floor, and a couple of the Redstone rockets were out there, and he had guys with torches and sparks and everything, and the director kind of took him over to the side and said, "And they pay me for this." So the influence was that I was always looking for something that I could go home at the end of the day and say, "And they pay me for this."
Any teachers, particularly in high school, who attended to your interest in science?
Well, I would go earlier than that. Even in grade school, there were particular teachers that stood out a lot. And you know, I'm not quite sure that they were great at science or allowed me to do that better, but even all these years later, I can remember specific things that they allowed me to do that was just special. So I remember a fourth grade teacher, she just let me do little things in the back of the class. And they gave me special instruction in math and some other things, and just allowed me to do what I wanted to do at my old pace. Oh. And it was a very good way to learn.
Uh-huh. High school, did you have any?
Yeah, high school is very good. So it was when my education, undergraduate, well, it's mixed, but going backwards, grade school was excellent. Seventh and eighth grade was kind of this lost 2 years for some reason in our school system. It was a disaster. And then in high school, Oak Park is a very large high school, and they had very good science and math programs there.
Uh-huh.
And I was suddenly thrown in with a bunch of very smart other kids. So it was a lot of fun to be with. So science and math were taught very well in my high school, and I enjoyed it a lot.
Uh-huh. Did you have other intellectual interests? Were you interested in English or history, too, or just what you had to do to get
Math by? Was my favorite. I certainly enjoyed reading a lot, but I wouldn't say I had a strong interest compared to other people.
Uh-huh.
But math is what I had a special talent for in high school. But I thought that being a professional mathematician versus a biologist, I thought I would actually enjoy day-to-day being a biologist more.
Uh-huh. Now, I saw on your resume that you were a National Merit Scholar, and that must have been in your senior year in high school.
Because I have an old resume. I haven't had that on there for years. updated one.
It's one I found up in Bascom.
Oh,
do you think it was at that point that you realized that you were a scholar or exceptionally bright?
No, it was the math.
It was the math.
Yeah, I scored well in those national competitions in high school.
Uh-huh.
And you know, by the time you're a national merit scholar, that's senior year, and you already kind of know where you're standing.
So you graduate from high school and you go to University of Illinois.
Yeah, I was broke. So it turned out that there was an extraordinarily good biology program there, which I was just visiting there the other week, and the last graduating class will be this May. Their administrators are tearing it up, which is really sad. But it's produced a number of really extraordinary individuals in the sciences, and it was a very, very special program. And Illinois has, I don't know, 40,000 students or something, and I think there's like 2,000 life science majors. And this little program had 25 people a year and had two full-time professors attached to those 25 people. And to get into the program, you're interviewed by the students that enrolled during the program. And it was predominantly selecting for people that thought science was cool. So it was this wonderful little nest in this large bureaucratic university, where you know those 25 or 30 people simply loved science, and they worked at it really, really hard, and the bar was high. You know, they expected great things out of these people, and now they're populating all the universities in the country. It's been a phenomenally successful program. So, for example, one of the major stem cell researchers at Harvard, Doug Melton, came out of the exact same program about 5 years before I did, and it's a funny little world that we ended up in the same area.
But you went to Illinois dictated by financial considerations more than the program?
Oh, no, it was just lucky the program was there because, yeah, no, it was entirely financial consideration.
And you didn't look anywhere else?
Yes, I did. For a variety of financial reasons, I couldn't go anywhere else.
Now, in one of the articles, you talk about a Professor Fred.
Oh, Fred Mines, yeah.
Fred Mines.
And so he was the one in that particular program.
Uh-huh.
And he was just, I don't know where my life would be without him, but he was at that very critical stage as an undergraduate. I'd already kind of liked biology, but I could have gone off and done other things. I was actually better at math than I was at biology. But it was that particular relationship and that particular course that sent me on this track that I'm on.
Are you still in touch with him?
It's probably been a couple years now, but sporadically on.
So Professor Mines has followed your career.
Yeah, so Fred, he was at Illinois only for a few years. He came from Princeton to Illinois, and then he took a job at what's called the Friedrich Miescher Institute in Basel.
Oh.
And he's been there ever since. My understanding is they're disbanding that now, which is a shame, and they're keeping him on because he does something relevant to whatever C.B. Coggi's called now. But he, after I was an undergraduate, because he'd already gone to Basel, he took me on there for a while right before graduate school. And it's been, although I haven't seen him for a number of years, I suspect if I sat down with him, it would feel like no time has intervened. It was a very good special relationship.
Now, was it under his tutelage or generally while you were at the university that you started getting engaged with stem cells?
Not stem cells per se, but in terms of developmental biology, I had a bunch of different interests, and it kind of narrowed the field down to that in part because of him. He's actually a plant biologist, but he's a plant developmental biologist. And I got to know him when I was a sophomore, and in my freshman year I'd worked in a biophysics lab, and that was actually my major as an undergraduate. And he, because he came out of Princeton, he got me an NSF fellowship to go to Princeton the following summer in a well-known developmental biologist lab. And he also got me, he helped me get to a comparable position at Woods Hole the following summer, and then the following summer was in Basel. And each of those were different developmental biologists. And, it gave me a nice grounding in developmental biology, but at that point, embryonic stem cells had not been described yet. It was several years before that.
So. Okay. Now, you majored in biophysics. Was that an obvious choice for you?
No, it was kind of the dartboard senior year. I had a lot of credits. And I thought, okay, which one describes my interests the best? I like biology and I like physics. Okay, what is called biophysics? So I could have had a degree in several other things. I just chose that one.
I see.
And in a sense, it's unfortunate because honors biology was the thing that really shaped me as an undergraduate. And I never actually got the degree. I just went through the program. And I ended up with this biophysics degree, which is just fine. But it doesn't mark me as one of theirs very well.
Well, maybe by now they.
Oh, they've already done.
They'd be willing to claim you. And so from there, it looks like from your resume you made a very, you didn't linger, you went right on to graduate school at Pennsylvania. How did you choose Pennsylvania, and why veterinary medicine?
Yeah, they're actually two different answers, but I became interested in mammalian developmental biology from some things I did learn as an undergraduate. And there was a classic experiment that was published in 1974 where there's a tumor cell line called an embryonic carcinoma. And this is the cancer equivalent embryonic stem cells. And those cancer equivalent cells have been derived, you know, intellectual precursors go back to the 50s, but the first cell lines were derived in 1970 and people were beginning to use them. And in 1974, a fellow named Ralph Brinster took some of these cancer cells, injected them into a normal mouse embryo, and put that embryo back into a mother. And those cancer cells participated in normal development, which is a remarkable thing, because it went from this neoplastic thing to a normal development thing. And I was very interested in that experiment, and that's the reason I went to Penn originally. And so this is prior to embryonic stem cells, they hadn't been made yet. And I worked in Brinster's lab my first summer there, and he made the first transgenic mouse the summer that I was there, and I was in the lab when he did that. But intellectually, we were just not on the same wavelength, and I decided after that first summer it wasn't the lab I wanted to be in, and then I found out my advisor was across the street, and I ended up going to him. But yeah, it's funny how the news media has kind of like followed me over the years, because the first transgenic mouse was a big deal back then, and he was, you know, on CBS Evening News in the middle of my living room in, you know, 1982, I think it was. And then the second rotation, I did it, my what ended up being my advisor, and his lab developed the nuclear transfer technique that ultimately led to Dolly. And again, that was CBS Evening News, you know, the second rotation.
So you've been on the fringes of national news for a long time.
It's odd how that's followed me over the years, but Dauber Solter was my advisor ultimately. We just intellectually we hit it off well.
And so you worked on your veterinary degree for 4 years till.
Yeah, it's a combined program. It was structured like the MD PhD programs. So I went to veterinary medicine for some practical reasons. I had, going back to an undergraduate, I was at Woods Hole trying to figure out, you know, what I want to be when I grow up. And I was interested in developmental biology and population biology. I had some interest in conservation. And trying to decide kind of between those two. And this summer I was actually doing population biology. And I remember one night going to a lecture, and it was a conservation biologist out of Stanford called Paul Ehrlich. And he gave a lecture on genetic diversity and he very quickly made a statement about, you know, you need a population size of whatever it is, a couple hundred, to maintain a reasonable genetic bottleneck. And that if you calculate, you know, the size of all the zoos in the world and you figure out how many warm bodies you had to put in, then that there's a complete mismatch and completely discounted that the zoos could do anything. And I sat there thinking, well, you know, I've heard about all these reproductive technologies and cows and stuff, and, you know, I would think that if you could freeze a lot of semen, that you could increase N to whatever you wanted and just keep a standing population and, you know, some reasonable thing. And I wasn't aware that people were thinking about that. But that very night, there was a special with Walter Cronkite in the San Diego Zoo, and I just, you know, just come from home from the lecture, and Barbara Durant had this rat in her hand. And it was from a frozen embryo. And I was thinking, I'm going to do that. So I went back the following year to, you know, the head of the honors biology program, and I told her, I'm going to go to vet school. And she went, her like face dropped. You're going to do what? You can go anywhere you want. What the hell are you going to vet school for? And I explained the reasons I was going, and like a good parent, she helped me out. And Penn had the only combined program in the country at that time, and it was a scholarship program, so you got free ride. So I applied for that and I got in. And I had the original reasons for going to the primate center, I thought I could marry the two between doing population biology and using these reproductive technologies to maintain primate species and also do developmental biology. And in my postdoc, I actually did a little field work in Sulawesi in Indonesia. With a particular endangered macaque called Macaca nigra. And that particular species had gone from, I think, around 300,000 in the early 70s at one survey down to 6,000 by the time that I got there, and the population was going drop dead. And Macaca nigra is the only non-human primate model for a particular form of diabetes. And I thought, with, you know, the population dynamics and the fact that it's a good model, that I could sell this NH pretty easily. And I did some preliminary work in the field to kind of show we could get liquid nitrogen out to the field and put the idea that we could collect semen from the remnant population. And I applied for a grant, and you know, my postdoc is coming to an end in, say, April, you know, and I'm waiting for the grant. And they call me up and say, well, you scored pretty well. You're the third, you know, of the other people that applied, you're number three. And I kept waiting for the grant. And you know, by the time April came and the money ran out, I didn't have a position there, so I ended up accepting a position here as a pathology resident.
Oh, so you were in Oregon,
right?
And that's I was going to ask you yeah. how you ended up here.
And then after I was here about 6 months, I got this call from NIH and said, "We're sorry to hear you left. You got the grant. And it was one that you couldn't transfer because it had to be site specific and you know whatever." So I came here because John Hearn was the director of the Primate Center at that time, and he came out of the London Zoo and the research facility he had there, and he had a very good reputation for reproductive biology and primates and conservation both, and there's not a whole lot like that. And I decided after the Oregon experience, there was a big cutback in funds for the Primate Center system, and people who've been there for 30 years lost their jobs. And it used to be, you know, you got a professor type job in a Primate Center system and you got this nice cushy research stream, and you know, it was very nice, but then there's a budget scrunt and there was no tenure and people were showing the door. So I was looking around going, do I want to work here? And I kind of looked around and said, that pathologist, they can't fire him, that's essential. So I went to do my pathology resident, and I got board certified and became the pathologist in the Primate Center here, and it was my equivalent of tenure because you get paid just as well because there are very few of them out there. And as long as I did a halfway competent job, there's no way in hell they're going to fire me because there's almost no private pathologists out there. And what that allowed is it gave me 50% time really protected for research. And unlike an academic job, you know, I didn't have committee meetings, I didn't have a lot of the baggage that went with it. And also I didn't have a tenure clock. And it took me, see, I got here in 91, I guess. We'd have to look this up.
91.
I think it's 91. And I derived human embryonic stem cells in 1999. Subtract those two dates. If I went in a typical tenure track, I wouldn't have gotten tenure. But it was
that's very interesting.
But because I just kind of went outside the system and I kind of dabbled into what I wanted to over time, I could ignore the system. I could take on this highly risky thing, and it turned out okay. And if it failed, it's fine. I still had a day job. It's one of the little known facts within the university. That was not a tenure track professor when I directed embryonic stem cells. And I think the university, there's a certain hubris associated with faculty positions, and I think they were fairly embarrassed by that fact. There are like, you know, academic staff research awards. It was encouraged that this not be applied for.
I assume that you are now tenured
yeah,
here
yeah.
at the university.
But nonetheless, and even that's not, I might as well be blunt. It was clear that there were not going to be any investment from the university in stem cells unless it became a faculty member. You know, they didn't like that discrepancy. Never said in that many words, but from my point of view, I had tenure. I was getting paid what an associate professor at the medical school made, so no issue to me. And they also offered me an assistant professor job, and I kind of looked at that as a demotion because, you know, suddenly I can lose my job, and over here I got like a tenure job. So I turned it down twice, and it wasn't like a negotiation or anything. I just, you know, was going to walk away from it. And then finally, I decided that, you know, I can have postdocs, but there is a certain vibrancy with having graduate students, and that it'd probably be good to have, you know, that. So I ended up accepting it. And this was in 1999, and I gave a keynote address at the National Academy of Sciences, and the guy from Columbia that was introducing me said, "Oh, this has to be a typo. You know, it's an assistant scientist." And Andy Cohen went back to the chancellor and said, "You know," but still, you know, 1999, nothing happened. And then what happened was that, you know, George Bush was elected. So this is, you know, 2000 now or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And for that first 6 months, because of his indecision, stem cells were on the first page of every major newspaper for, you know, 6-7 months, something like that. It was up until August 11th. And suddenly the university got scared it was going to leave. And it had nothing to do with the science. So the science gave this scientific breakthrough of the year in 1999.
Uh-huh.
And that didn't get me promoted. But suddenly in 2001, when it became this big, you know, Time Magazine thing, they double promoted me to full professor, which has never happened in the history of the University of Wisconsin, which...
From assistant to full.
Yeah, and from my point of view, they could have made me associate to start off with, you know, and then they wouldn't have had a problem there. But I'd have to say that, well, I don't take the academics system too seriously. In my training, it's out of research labs and institutes. And so WISTAR is where I did my training for Penn. It just happens to be on the Penn campus. And I'm more comfortable with that. And I don't know why exactly, but the faculty thing still gives me a little bit of uncomfort.
Well, one of my questions for you was, how has the university been of assistance and a barrier? And you've sort of addressed
that. Well, the university's never been a barrier. But I can tell you, in like, you know, 1998 or 1999, although people were supportive and, you know, nonetheless, I made people extraordinarily nervous when I walked in a room. You know, people were worried about their federal funding in this research. And you know, I was not a tenured faculty member, and I was very cognizant of the fact that if I screwed up, you know, there would be somebody else taking the fall for it. And the university, you know, never said anything positive, but there wasn't a whole lot of investment back then. So in 1999, at the request of the university, WARF set up YSEL, which is a reasonable thing to do because in 1999, there was no federal policy. It was illegal to use federal funds to derive embryonic stem cells. That was clear. It was ambiguous whether federal funds could be used for embryonic stem cells. Finally, some lawyers at NIH said it was possible, but in that period, we were worried about being felons. So the university requested YSEL to be set up to get off campus. And so WARF has, over the years, made a significant investment and, you know, actually tried to see the science go forward. The university itself hasn't really invested much of anything.
I was going to ask you about the significance of WARF. I mean, I know that it's been significant, but you're making it sound like WARF perhaps was critical to your work here.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't have done this work without WARF. On the other hand, WARF screwed up big time a couple times too. So prior to the current people at WARF. So in 1995, we published rhesus embryonic stem cells. And it was that experience that led directly to human embryonic stem cells because they're different than mouse. And I, you know, disclosed to WARF that this might be patentable. And it was actually surprising to me at the time there was patentable because it has the distinction of what is patentable and what is not was not clear to me at the time. But how we tried to do it was relatively obvious. But it was absolutely not clear or obvious whether it would work or not. And given that there had been failures by a lot of other people over the last decade, it was completely not obvious whether it worked, although the particular conditions we used were very similar to what had been previously used for the mouse. So it was patentable. But back then, there used to be this university industrial relations branch, which was, yes, among other things, doled out these small grants for things. And that the purpose of the UIR grants was to take some UW invention and make it more commercially applicable. And we had this patent on primate embryonic stem cells, and I wrote a very modest little grant saying, you know, if we could make human embryonic stem cells, that would be useful too, you know, and it would increase the breadth of this patent. And they turned it down.
Really?
And it was because the head of UIR at the time was scared of it. And although they said, oh, I'm sorry, we don't have any money, the fact was that he said, well, you know, if the federal government's not paying this, should we? And
scared of the political repercussions?
Well, yeah, he didn't, you know, people were scared back then. So 1 week later, Geron Corporation wandered into my office, you know, after I got turned down by the university, and said, hey, we'd like to fund you. And they ended up funding me, and because of that, they ended up with a very strong commercial position, which is not benefiting the university because it's too restrictive. Now, WARF has changed since then. They have a better feeling for what they have and why, and the director of WARF has changed. But they're really trying to correct some serious errors that were made before they got there.
Jamie, I want to go back and ask you at what point working with human stem cells came into your world. Had you been aspiring to that longer before you...
Not really, no. So when I was a graduate student, and so Dauber Solter, my advisor, one is one of the original embryologists and mouse embryologists. There's a very small number in like the 60s and 70s, and he was one of those. And he was one of the people working on the malignant equivalent to embryonic stem cells, these embryonic carcinoma cells. And it was 1980 when somebody figured out how to drive embryonic stem cells in the mouse. And there's only a couple labs that could do it back then. And I finished my thesis a little earlier than I was supposed to, and my postdoc wasn't ready in Oregon. So he kept me on for about a 6-month gap, just kind of as interim funding. And as part of that, I went to one of the better labs to learn how to drive mouse embryonic stem cells. His name is Colin Stewart, who's up at Nutley at the time. Uh-huh. And he was one of like 3 people in the world that knew how to do this. So he taught me how to do it. And it was over beer at lunchtime that we just chatted about things. And I said, I'm going off to this primate center. And, you know, there'd be a lot of good reasons to derive embryonic stem cells from primates and blah, blah, blah. And then he told me stories about people that had tried to derive human ones in Britain in the 80s and failed. And I'd say up to that point, I, you know, no interest at all in driving human embryonic stem cells. But even at that point, I went to Oregon, I did some basic embryology, didn't really pursue the embryonic stem cells, it's kind of the back of my brain, but didn't have very good access to the embryos. And I was basically starved for embryonic material. You get one embryo per rhesus monkey and it comes out to like $2,000 an embryo. So you can't do an experiment that takes 100 embryos, it's not possible. And one of the limiting steps back then was that embryos were produced by in vitro fertilization. And the culture medium you used to go from one cell up to the stage that embryonic stem cells are derived was really bad. So I never really tried it at Oregon. But John Hearn had set up a program to recover normal embryos, not from in vitro fertilization, but the actual blastocyst embryos from the reproductive tract. They came up with a non-surgical way of doing that, and I knew about that. So he hired me as a postdoc to try to derive primate embryonic stem cells. And so I came here to do my pathology residency, and at the same time as doing a postdoc driving primate embryonic stem cells. And we derived the rhesus monkey ones, published that in 1995, and the common marmosets, and published that in 1996, although we had both of those sometime in the early 90s. It just took us a while to publish them. And at that time, I figured that somebody else would very quickly derive the human ones, because, you know, the conditions were obviously going to be the same. The rhesus ones, the marmoset ones were the same. And that's an old world species and a new world species, and the millions of years that separate those is actually more than the rhesus monkey to humans. So we're pretty confident the same exact approach would work. And I kind of figured that, you know, once we published that, somebody with better access to embryos would do it. But then nobody did. So we kind of looked into trying to figure out if we should do it, and I decided, well, nobody's actually published
it. So you were kind of waiting to see if somebody else would.
I wasn't really waiting, but I was just anticipating that by the time we got set up to do it, somebody else would have beaten us already. And, you know, so I decided that, well, might as well try. And it turned out that we did beat everybody, but not by a lot.
Were you, when you decided that you would go ahead and try, were you making an assessment at that time that if you were successful, you knew that this would change your life?
Oh, yeah. I actually thought a long time about whether I wanted to do it. Because Dolly, especially by the time Dolly was published, which was 1997, you know, you already knew what kind of media storm was going to hit. And I don't particularly enjoy that. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I said at the end of the day, I could live with it. But no, I thought a lot about whether I wanted to do it or not.
It was at that time that you started talking to Norman Faust and Alta Charles here?
Talked to Alta. I'm not sure I met Norm back too much then. Alta is the one I chatted with. And then as we went through the consent process, Norm was the one overseeing that. But I don't think I personally got to know him very well at that point.
And what were you and Alta Charles talking about? What was the issue? What were the issues that you were presenting?
So she was, when Clinton was elected, Harold Varmus convened a committee or a panel to look at the issues of human embryonic stem, not human embryonic stem cell research, but human embryo research, part of which would be human embryonic stem cell research. And in the fall of 1994, that report was published, and Alta was on that panel. And so I read over that, and I looked at the Warnock Commission out of Britain, and just kind of ran through my mind what I thought about things. And then when I chatted with her, I pretty much made up my mind already, but I was just kind of seeing if I'm missing anything, you know. So we just had a nice conversation about things and what I planned to do and how I should go. And there weren't any really specific issues I needed to address with it. I was just kind of bouncing off where I was going and what the implications were.
At your recent talk at the Overture Center, when you were giving one of your lectures to explain to a lay audience about your work, there was someone from the religious right who asked you the question about sacrificing life, and your response was, and what is in much of your background material, is that these are embryos that were going to be discarded anyway. And that was your judgment at this time in
right.
the mid-90s?
Right. Actually, you can answer the question on a variety of different levels, but it came down to that. Is it if the destiny of these embryos is simply to be discarded, it would be a better ethical decision to use them in some way that would benefit people. And people disagree with that because some people say that, you know, it's demonstrating a lack of respect, even if you are going to discard it, to be using it in this tool kind of fashion. But that's what it ultimately came down to.
In one of the background articles, you're described as a, I think by one of your former roommates perhaps, as a non-practicing Congregationalist. So I take it from that, you know, you had a religious upbringing and you confronted, like all Americans, various religious ethical issues, and you're quite comfortable with the work that you're doing now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It restricted that population of embryos. I have no qualms about it at all. And I have to say that I'm a little bit tired about the ethical debate. It hasn't changed. I mean, all the basic issues were brought out in that 1994 report. And I took it very seriously then. I looked through it very carefully. But now it's getting very repetitious, and there's nothing new. The one thing that is new is Dolly, because that Dolly hadn't been cloned in 1994. And that does change ethical debate in a subtle way that hasn't really caught up with people. And because a lot of the arguments about the
This is side two of tape one of the November 3rd, 2005 interview with Professor James Thompson.
So to reiterate the last sentence, I can't remember exactly, but you know, any of the criteria that you use to establish time of death, whether it's, you know, brain activity or heart activity, the embryo doesn't have. So the ethical arguments for, you know, calling that a human life are really based on potential rather than, you know, that one cell thing. And Dolly really changed that argument a lot, because potential in this absolute sense, every cell in your body has the potential to become a human being. You have to manipulate a little bit, but it has that potential in a raw sense. And if you talk about, you know, a cell in a liquid nitrogen tank, and I tell you if I take that cell out and I manipulate a little bit, and then I put it back into a woman, it becomes a baby, what can you conclude about the status of that cell? We can't, because that cell could have been a somatic cell from your body, or it could have been an actual fertilized embryo. So it's getting harder and harder to give, you know, qualitative reasons why that embryo is the equivalent of a child. But again, you can kind of ignore those higher levels of examination of, you know, whether this is a good thing or a bad thing, and simply ask if it's simply going to be discarded, can you do this? And you can come to the same conclusion independently of what you think the status of the embryo is. And even if you think it's the equivalent of a human being and you know that it's going to be discarded and you can't change that fact, is it ethical to actually use it in a way to help people? And you can conclude that it is.
Uh-huh. Now, you said you were getting a little tired of the debate. Are you surprised at how long this has gone on?
Yeah, so I underestimated by a lot. I figured, well, I've seen Dolly, you know, people are already a little tired of biological stuff, that I gave it 3 to 6 months, you know, that there'll be this big peak of interest and it would go away. And if it wasn't for the election of George Bush, I think that would have been true.
And is that your judgment, that it was the decision of the electorate to elect the second Bush as president that has kept the debate alive?
Oh, absolutely. You know, if it had been reduced to everyday science, you know, we'd just be doing it now. It's just because initially it's indecision and then a compromise, you know, the debate keeps going and going.
Do you think, and this is pure speculation, but if Al Gore had been elected president, do you think that the tenor of the times would have permitted him to?
So the funny thing is, in a funny backhanded sort of way, although 8 years is a long time, there are some reasons why having Bush elected instead of Gore is helpful for the field.
Really?
And the reason is that, you know, he is likely within the, you know, the range of presidents we've had in our history to be the most restrictive in this area, and he let it go forward. And it confers legitimacy to the field that a liberal Democrat would not have conferred. Now, what happened with the fetal tissue research, every time they would switch administrations, investigators had no idea whether you could do that anymore, because it would be banned in the Reagan administration and okay in the Clinton administration. And that uncertainty was really a bad thing. So the particular compromise that was brought up in 2001, that only cell lines prior to that date can be used, is not good public policy, but it does open the door. It does create it as a legitimate area of research, and we're not going backwards anymore. It'll only go forwards. And who knows, had Gore been elected, would that be true now? Because, like within our own state legislatures, becoming this big Democratic versus Republican issue, and had Gore been elected, the Republicans that are now supporting this might have just not, because, you know. So it could actually be beneficial in the long run. I wish it was only 4 years instead of 8. Now.
Are you dismayed or resigned to the intrusion of the political process into your basic science research?
I guess I'm resigned more than dismayed. And it certainly has slowed this process a great deal in my field. And it's hard to quantitate how much. But certainly prior to that Bush decision, you know, there's basically 3 years in there where there is no federal policy at all. And our lab got nothing done. We couldn't bring samples over to the university. We couldn't use all the expensive equipment here for DNA or RNA or anything. And that lack of decision and lack of implementation by the Clinton administration also basically stopped the field for 3 years, because, you know, we are pretty well set up here, and if we can't do it, then the average investigator can't do it. So if you could get that 3 years back, we'd be 3 years ahead. But it's also kind of understandable, is that, you know, these issues were created by in vitro fertilization in the 70s. Human yes cells did not create these issues. But we never really confronted them. You know, there was certainly in the 70s, 80s, a lot of talk about in vitro fertilization, but it was just kind of pushed off to the back burner for a while, never really resolved. And in vitro fertilization and fertility affects, you know, a significant part of the population, but it's a relatively small and seen part of the population. Whereas embryonic stem cells can influence most people in the population. So suddenly it came back and percolated back up as an issue. But it didn't create those issues, it just inherited them. So it's, and it's understandable that societies and people and culture take time to change about things. And, you know, whatever the status of that embryo is, it's not something that's going to be decided and society is going to come to a consensus in a year or so. It'll take generations ultimately. And I do believe that status, even within religious faith, will change over time. There's just too many contradictions of calling a one-cell fertilized embryo equivalent to a child. There's no individuation that early. If you put two of them together that are genetically dissimilar, you get one individual. You take four blastomeres and take them apart, you get four individuals. There's no correspondence to what we consider as individuals. And I think ultimately, if people have to draw lines based on individuation, it'll be later. So dismayed, no. Resigned, yes.
Can you talk on the record what some of your expectations for where your research is going to go in the next 5 to 10 years?
Yes, I said I can tell you what we've done historically and what we're doing now, and can't predict how successful it would be. So the human embryonic stem cells is a new model system, and an awful lot of what we've done, certainly for the first 5 years, and even extending it to now, is just getting the nuts and bolts and kinks out of using that system. So a lot of it are things like getting DNA into the cells to change them genetically, or growing them better and more efficiently, or and a lot of papers have been kind of, gee whiz, we can make blood, and gee whiz, we can make neurons, and gee whiz, we're making heart cells. And, you know, although all the clinical applications are in those areas, what I've decided to do is to establish a number of good collaborations with MDs and PhDs on campus that know a lot more about the clinical applications of those cells, and let them take the lead on those particular lineages. And instead of diluting my own research, I kind of step back and say, what do I actually personally find cool about all this? And I decided that it's not making pancreas cells or heart cells, it's actually the cell itself, and trying to understand what's special about a cell that can form anything in the whole body versus the rest of your cells that can't. And we can say remarkably little about that. We can kind of talk about some of the genes in there, and we know if we take out of some of those genes, it doesn't have this property anymore. But I can't write you a simple, understandable paragraph about why one cell can form everything another cell can't. So that's the goal of my lab, is to write such a little paragraph. And some of what we do is practical. We are trying to just grow the cells better. Originally had all these contamination issues with fibroblasts and serum, things like that. So we spent a lot of time in growing the cells better. We've done a really good job with that. We're probably going to back away from that a little bit now. And then related to this pluripotency thing is the question of how does it become itself, which is called self-renewal, versus deciding to become something else, differentiation. So that balance of decision is what we're focusing on now. So I don't know if it'll be successful, but I'd be pleased if when I retire, I can, like, you know, write your paragraph to him and say, if you gave me two cells, this is why one could do everything and one can't. And I'd like to have personally written a couple of those sentences. That would be the goal for my lab.
Yeah, I'd like to get those two paragraphs.
We'll come back in 25 years and see if we can. And there's, although it's a theoretical interest, there's practical reasons for that too, is that in your body, differentiated cells don't want to go backwards. They don't do it typically. Dolly, the message of Dolly is not that you can clone people or sheep. It's that you can take a differentiated cell and you can go backwards. And this surprised people. And there was actually glimmerings of the same thing way back in the 70s. But the lab that I came out of actually wrote this famous paper in Nature, the last sentence of which says, and this shows that cloning is impossible. So the fact that you can actually go backwards turned out to be a big deal. And that's refocused people on the stability of the differentiated state, trying to understand how and why it goes backwards. And if you can do that, you can imagine repairing tissues that normally don't repair themselves, because if the cells potentially can go backwards, it's just a matter of time before we figure out how to tell them how to do it. And then things like, you know, heart muscle, whatever, that physically doesn't repair itself, you might be able to tease it into a way that does repair it. So understanding that special state of being able to form everything, how that state is restricted to a cell that can't form anything, and how to go backwards, that's the dynamics we want to understand. And it has a lot of clinical implications.
And that's what is the popular affection for stem cell. Is it not that somehow magically with these stem cells you're going to be able to repair a heart muscle?
Right, but that's actually not the popular. The popular one is you simply make heart cells and you squirt it back into the body and repair the heart. And that'll probably be true. To actually cause the body to repair itself is likely to be a lot harder, but I think understanding the cells will also lead to that.
Now, are you and your work here still the leader in the nation on stem cell work?
In terms of what we publish, that's probably true, but there's now an exponential growth in the field, and it'll probably be impossible to identify a single lab as the leader. There'll be, you know, a top tier of labs, but it's too broad of a field to be in any kind of dominant position anymore. It'd be like recombinant DNA and molecular biology. You know, there used to be probably half dozen good labs in the world, and now there's thousands and thousands, and like, who's the best molecular biologist level? Who knows, you know? Stem cell biology is going through a similar growth phase right now. There's the International Society of Stem Cell Research, and it was founded only 3 years ago. So we started with, like, you know, 12 board members, and then it's had, like, I don't know, a couple hundred or something, but it's gone up to 2,200 in 3 years, and it's just exploding. So am I the best one of that 2,200? We're up there.
And you're probably pleased with the growth in the number of labs.
You think I would be, but you know, it's just no fun anymore.
We're not going to edit that comment out.
Oh, no, that's fine, but it's true. It's that, you know, I don't like large meetings. I like meetings that it's a relatively small number of people that you interact with well with. Whereas when you get a meeting that has several thousands, you can't find anybody, and it's this big, kind of cumbersome thing. And the field's become that already.
So
I'm pleased that it made that impact, but the field's not as fun as it used to be.
Do you envision that you are going to have to spend more and more time testifying in Congress and giving presentations about the significance?
No,
of
I did an awful lot of that from 1998-2001.
Uh-huh.
I kind of feel like I did my duty, you know. And sometimes you can't say no, but for the most part, I say no now. Essentially, we've won. And it's gone from, you know, 1999, I had no idea how this would go over. You know, it was brand new, controversial. The public perception of this could have gone all the way from, you know, real cool science to being on the cover of Time, it's Jeffrey Dahmer's instead. It was really not clear back then. But public opinion polls in both the Senate and the House are very strongly supportive overall in a very skewed way now. And although there are restrictions which are onerous right now, they're going to go away in time.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about our own state legislature here?
It would be good to get the petty partisan politics out of it, and I think an awful lot of that is involved with what's happening in the state legislature. If you look at the federal level, this is not a Democrat or Republican issue, and it's unfortunate the Kerry issue tried to make, the Kerry campaign tried to make it that. You know, it spans the way from Teddy Kennedy, which is like as liberal as you can get, to Orrin Hatch, who's about as conservative as you can get. They're both very strongly supportive.
Oh, I didn't realize Hatch supported.
Hatch made a big impact in July of 2001. He wrote a personal letter to the president, which is 10 or 12, 15 pages long, outlining in a very detailed personal way why he thought this ethically should be supported. And, you know, I differed with him on a lot of issues, obviously, but that took a lot of guts, because it's certainly not something that helped him get reelected in the state of Utah. But him and several other key conservatives did the same thing at the same time, and that's what brought us to that compromise, because it's prior to the compromise. So Hatch and some other ones have been steadily supportive. And if you look at our own state, I don't follow politics very closely, but you know, Tommy Thompson and our current governor didn't agree on a whole lot, as far as I can tell, you know, over the years that they're in the state together. They both support this, and you know, they're kind of at opposite poles and opposite camps, and Tommy Thompson was very supportive of this, and Jim Doyle is also. And I think our legislature is a little out of step with reality, and I hope that they get a little closer into step. But I do think it has degenerated into kind of partisan politics, because the current governor is not a Republican, and I hope they get beyond that.
How dependent are you in your lab on state of support for the university? Zero.
Other than the building, it funds none of my research at all.
So, aside from the impact on the emotional climate surrounding your work, there's not a fiscal impact.
No. Well, it could actually support me. That'd be good. Yeah, but yeah, if there's states that are, besides California, putting hundreds of millions of dollars in this, and the state legislatures elsewhere are doing that, and this one is not. And that makes a big difference, because it's hard to compete.
Yes, there was. You wrote a very interesting column for the State Journal.
Actually, that was a personal letter, which they just decided to print.
Oh, okay, well. And you talked about the Midwest as flyover country, and Wisconsin has a chance to either feed the popular impression or to step forward. Did you get much reaction from anybody in the legislature?
Just the people that are already supportive of it. The only reaction I had was for the people not supportive, it was negative. But I had a lot of personal emails from people I haven't heard in years and years because of that article.
Good. Now, in terms of the Department of Genetics here and the university, who are your colleagues? Who are you working with here on campus?
Well, there's a core, there's a lot of different people, but in terms of those core MD PhDs, there's been four or five of them, which I've collaborated with for years now, even back to the rhesus cells. And they're kind of the ones at the forefront of ultimately getting this into the clinics. And this campus is very good for that. You know, administratively, you know, whatever, the legislature, whatever, this is a good campus when you get down to the trenches with the people that are here. So John Oderico is a transplant surgeon. He does pancreatic transplants. UW is number two, I believe, in the country in pancreatic transplants, so it's a really important facility here. He just set up a beta islet cell transplant unit, which is taking cadaver islet cells and putting them into patients. It's one of only a few in the country. Hmm. And his entire research program is devoted to making embryonic stem cells go to pancreatic beta cells. I've interacted with him, I don't know, probably close to 10 years now, something like that. So he's over, you know, in the medical school and the surgery department. Tim Camp is an MD, PhD. He's an electrophysiologist. And again, it's somebody I've known since like 1995 with the rhesus cells. And he's an electrophysiologist that wants to use cardiac cells from human ES cells to understand the basic physiology of the heart. But he's also gearing up to do transplantations to monkey models at the Primate Center to see if he can actually repair infarcts or not. So that's an ongoing project. Igor Slutkin's, I've known him for about 10 years as a postdoc, but he's just now a new faculty member in pathology, and he's at the Primate Center, and he's studying blood differentiation in human yeast cells and already has really good results doing that. Sushen Zhang is an investigator now at the Weizmann Center, and again, I've known him for like 8 years or 9 years, something like that. And he can already make dopaminergic neurons from human yeast cells, which is the neuron that's defective in Parkinson's disease at a very high frequency, basically in unlimited numbers. And he can make motor neurons, which is the defective neuron in ALS, again, at very high frequencies. And Weizmann has this cell manufacturing facility, which is GMP cell manufacturing facility. And there's very, very few of those in the country and in academic institutes. So this is one of the very few universities that have a primate center where we can do proper animal modeling all the way to clinical production of cells for cell-based therapies. And there's probably a couple others, but you know, like three or something.
So the structure here is one that's attractive to you. And because I'm sure that you get a lot of invitations to leave Wisconsin.
But yes, it's a very friendly kind of university to work at. I've been on the East and the West Coast, and people are very helpful here. You know, at Wistar, which is kind of a typical East Coast institution, I came from a very good lab, and I like my lab, but I didn't even know the guy down the hallway. And here, you know, there's what, 55 or so National Academy members. It's a decent number, and it's hard to tell who they are at first, because you know, their egos aren't quite there. But if you ever approach one with a problem because they have a particular expertise in the lab, they're almost always willing to help, and it's a very good collegial kind of atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. And are you glad to be back in the Midwest?
Well, I don't know. I guess I am. And now that I have kids and things, it seems like the natural place to be. Growing up in Illinois, I always felt like, God, what am I doing here? So I spent like, you know, 10 or 15 years away. And I was out in Oregon driving back to Wisconsin. You know, I had all my junk in a trailer behind the car. And I hit Minnesota, and there was a thunderstorm. And you know those, how smells give you a deja vu?
Yes.
I had this incredible sense of deja vu, and all of a sudden said, God, what am I doing? I'm coming back. But I am comfortable here. I wish there were some mountains and ocean here, but you know, people are nice.
Yes, I saw somewhere that you're a sea kayaker.
Yeah, they're gathering dust. A friend has them up in Sturgeon Bay.
Yeah, and the Great Lakes aren't.
The Great Lakes are okay. They're just kind of far away. I mean, Lake Superior is actually very nice for sea kayaking, but it's too far away for a weekend.
Yeah. Moving on, let me ask you why you think, in particular, these cells are so important.
So my feeling is that there's tremendous parallels between the early days of recombinant DNA and the early days of human yeast cells. And they're parallel in a whole bunch of different issues. But for example, recombinant DNA in the early 70s had the same kind of social controversy, same kind of front page news stories. And ultimately, compromises were made and the field went forward. And it's generally accepted, although there remains a segment of population which is against that particular technology. And there's the same kind of dramatic enthusiasm from the scientific community about the potential of this enabling kind of technology, similar to embryonic stem cells. And when it comes down to predictions, scientists are very good at understanding when something's really important, but they don't have very good crystal balls when it comes down to the details. And I think that's going to be true about this field. And if you think about the early days of recombinant DNA technology, I would be shocked if anybody predicted how pervasive a basic tool it became. I mean, nobody was thinking it'd be used for anthropology and forensics and manufacturing those proteins they make your whites white or white. And also people underestimated how certain applications would be, how difficult certain applications would be, like gene therapy. You know, gene therapy is one where people thought would be pretty straightforward. It would be one of the, like, the killer applications for recombinant DNA technology, and it probably will be. But we're 30 years in, and it's not widely used, and it's been very difficult to actually get to work. And then there's certain things that happened dramatically faster than anybody would have predicted, like the whole human genome sequence. Nobody in the 1970s would have predicted that. It would just been this phenomenal impossibility. So I think that there'll be very similar things happening with embryonic stem cells. My personal prediction is that some stem cell-based therapies will be successful, but for most diseases, it's going to be very, very challenging to get to work. And this is, you know, the pathologist in me speaking is it's not making the cells its heart, it's getting them back into the body in a physiologically useful form. And this has nothing to do with embryonic stem cells, it has to do with the pathology of the disease. When something's dead, there's a reason for it, and you got to correct that first before you put something back in, or it's going to die too. And for most diseases, that'll be the challenge. But when you just think of it from a kind of level of complexity, you know, gene therapy's been hard, and that's pretty easy, just one gene. Cells are harder, you know. So my guess is that this will be very important for people in disease within my lifetime, but it'll be pretty hard for most things and take decades, not years. Remains to be seen, there might be some easy ones that sneak through. But my other prediction is that this is a pervasive enabling technology, and there'll be thousands and thousands of people using these cells, and they won't call themselves stem cell biologists. It'll just be a tool in a toolbox that they use to understand the human body. And that that use to understand the human body will ultimately change medicine much more than transplantation biology. And we'll never know it, because it'll just be something going on in the background, and people won't never hit that front page.
So it will be a non-controversial
exactly
tool,
right,
that scientists...
So and there's a good analogy here, which I don't like to always talk about publicly, but in fetal tissue research, there's been on the order of magnitude of only 300 transplants for Parkinson's disease, give or take. It's been a few years since I've seen the statistics. And it's fair to say that the average patient has not benefited much. You know, there's some arguments about whether they benefit or not, but the average life, quality of life has not improved dramatically for those 300. And there's over a million people with Parkinson's in the United States, so it clearly hasn't made an impact today. And the people that oppose this research would point at that and say, see, it's a complete failure, we have to stop it. You know, it never benefited anybody. And, you know, they might have a point of view for that particular thing. So, but one of the little ironies about this is that there's a fetal tissue cell line derived called W38 at Wistar, where I did my work, by Len Hayflick, who has something called the Hayflick limit, you might have heard of. And that tissue cell line has been used in most, if not all, of the major vaccines developed in the United States since that date. So everybody sitting in Congress that's completely against fetal tissue research all have antibodies floating around in their bloodstream based on fetal tissue research. And when you think about, like, the ultimately most cost-effective way of dealing with disease in the population, well, vaccines at the top of the list. And fetal tissue research has made this very, very valuable contribution to that particular area of medicine. And nobody knows about that. It doesn't make the front pages. And same thing in Britain. There's another fetal tissue cell line that was derived there, and they've used it all in their vaccines for the last 20, 30 years or something like that. So my prediction is that human ES cells will go as an enabling technology in all sorts of different directions. And I know some of them, but most of them I won't get wrong. And the basic knowledge that we get from those different directions will change human medicine in very profound ways, but in ways that the public will never know about. It'll never hit the front pages at all. So I also predict that, you know, over the next decade or so, this will become routine, and people like this won't be interviewing me very often.
Now that makes me think that one thing that I did want to ask you about the environment, again, in which you're doing your work, at a time when the basic theory of evolution seems to be under attack, and the concept of science education in at least the public schools is certainly receiving lots of attention from people who seem not to support it. Is that going to have an impact on you?
Yeah, well, not just me, all science, and it's just scary. We were kind of, the United States does have a very dominant scientific position, but we also have this arrogance that we're going to stay there. And if you just look towards Asia a little bit, you know, they're doing a pretty good job educating their kids right now. We've got some problems. And I just gave a talk at the National Association of Biological Teachers two or three weeks ago. Huh. And, you know, some of them are from Kansas and the Dakotas, and where these issues are coming up. And they're looking like a very stressed group of people.
Well, it's even occurring here in Wisconsin, down in Grant County or somewhere. Jamie, tell us a little bit about YCell and YCell Research Institute.
It'll be interesting to see where it goes 10 years from now if I do another one of these interviews, because it was created in 1999 by Worf, originally just to distribute the cells, and there was one person to do that. But it's growing very rapidly now. We've become pretty successful at getting federal grants. We just became the the National Bank for the United States for Human Embryonic Stem Cells.
Yes.
Just a couple of weeks ago. And there's an interest in making it a robust, self-standing institute. We're chartered as a not-for-profit support organization of the University of Wisconsin. So our role is to support research at UW and elsewhere. But we have to establish better our own identity, and we're beginning to do that. So there's a discussions of making this institute very multidisciplinary, and having stem cells has been one of the enabling basic tools, but not having it as a stem cell institute. And there's discussions about, you know, how such an institute would be structured. And right now we have, it's gone from that, you know, one first hire, and we're somewhere between 20 and 30 FTEs at Y-Cell, and it's private and separate from the university. So there's issues about how we integrate with interview, you know, with the university, and deal with, you know, tenured appointments and things. But the way it's functioning now is that these MD PhDs and others are collaborators who have their own laboratories on the main campus, as I do. I don't have an office over at Y-Cell. But they have younger people that are either graduate students or postdocs over at Y-Cell. And one of both of the strengths and the weaknesses of this campus is it's large, and it's a very large biomedical research institution, but it's geographically distant between people. So John Oderico, who I've interacted for a great deal of time, he's over in the VA hospital, and it's like a mile from where we're sitting here. But he has a couple of postdocs over at Y-Cell. The idea is that this kind of mixes up all these disciplines with young people. The PIs are kind of out of the mix a little bit. As things are developed at Y-Cell, that should diffuse quickly back to the university. And right now we're limited for space, and if, you know, we get a new building, I'd be very interested in 10 years from now is what I think about the last 10 years.
Oh. Now, who is selling the cell lines?
Yeah, so selling is a touchy word because it's cost recovery.
Okay.
It was originally the accountants decided to charge $5,000 a cell line. And in spite of that, WRF was somewhere like $2 million negative. So it was being heavily subsidized, in spite of the fact that investigators are all getting pissed off because of the $5,000. But because we just got this national bank, the federal government's going to subsidize it. So the cost to investigators will just be $500 now. So it's Y-Cell that's doing this distribution.
Uh-huh. This concludes the interview with Professor Thompson. Thank you very much. And we'll be back in 10 years.
Thank you. Tuesday time, so it's kind of like a big thing.